how do you make wise decisions? That's what I want to talk to you about this session. And then how do you solve problems as quickly as possible, so that as quickly as possible you come to clarity, which lets you move with speed. It clears the fog out of your thinking and lets you move as quickly as you possibly can without trying to drive fast into deep fog. Okay? All right. The subject of decisions. If we're looking at decisions from this perspective, the key thing you're trying to keep in mind with decision making is actually wisdom. You're not trying to just make fast decisions, you're trying to make wise decisions. Let me explain wisdom just a minute. Scripture is very clear that the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. But notice what it does not say. The fear of the Lord is wisdom. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. Notice what it does not say. The glory of the Lord is the end. It doesn't say the glory of the Lord is wisdom. In my mind, the fear of the Lord is beginning, then you have wisdom, and the glory of the Lord is, the Lord gets the glory for the wisdom. But neither one of them claim to be wisdom. But what is wisdom? Solomon is very clear. Seek wisdom. Seek to be with wise people, etc. What is wisdom? Instead of just telling it to you, I'd like to show it to you. Get in your mind the wisest person you've ever known. Could be your father, your mother, your aunt, your uncle, your grandpa, your grandma, your pastor, your anyone. Who's the wisest person you've ever known? I'm not asking you to tell me. Just get them in mind. Everybody have one? Okay. Let me explain what happened when you would go to them with the situation you were facing. They would listen to you carefully, and then they would basically say three things. Well, I think if I were you, here's what I would consider doing. And then they would go on to explain, and here's why. And then they would bring to you a resource, which would be like, and I think I know someone that could help you with that. Or, have you read the book on this? Because I think that would be helpful to you right now. Or, here's a tape that you've got on it, etc. They had the ability to help you sort out what to do next, why that was important, and then bring the appropriate resource to bear on the need at hand. Correct? I believe that's wisdom. Is the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. Wisdom is knowing what to do next, knowing why that's important, knowing how to bring the appropriate resources, and then the glory of the Lord is, in fact, the end of wisdom. But basically, what you're doing is you're seeking wisdom. What you're trying to do also is to make a mature decision. Let me explain maturity. Maturity is putting process between opportunity and decision. Maturity is putting process between opportunity and decision. Let me explain. Let me illustrate. Let's say, for example, I say to you, hey, how'd you like to buy my car? Drive a car in, show it to you. You just look out the window and you say, how'd you like to buy my car? Anyone else not have one at all? Because if you've got one, don't take another one. But if you don't have one, take one, okay? So you look at my car and you say, yes, I'd like to buy it. That may turn out to be a good decision, but it wasn't a mature decision. It was a snap decision. A mature decision would put process between the opportunity to buy a car and the decision to buy a car. It would go something like this. Well, how many miles does your car have on it? What is the retail value of it? How many miles per gallon does it get? Is that diesel or regular or premium? Has it ever been in an accident? You'd ask certain questions that would help you come to a wise conclusion. That's maturity. A lot of young people, you know, say, hey, you want some marijuana? Yeah. There isn't the thought process of what might be the implications of that. You want to have sex? Sure. Let's, you know, it's like there's no process between. So it's an immature decision. What you're trying to do is make mature decisions that are very wise. A part of what you're trying to do is ask, you're trying to get the facts. Peter Drucker says, once the facts are clear, the decisions jump out at you. Once the facts are clear, the decisions jump out at you. And so what you're trying to do is ask the questions, learn to ask the questions that ferret out or find the facts so that the decision making is easy. And to the extent that you can do that in a speedy way, the faster, the better. Now, here's one of the things I explain in this booklet called Asking Profound Questions. If you ask profound questions, you will get profound answers. If you ask shallow questions, you'll get shallow answers. And if you ask no questions at all, you'll get no answers at all. So the more you can collect good questions, the better off you are. In other words, questions you've made up that all of a sudden just open someone up quickly, make a note of that and ask it again next time when you get into that situation. Collect questions like this booklet. Collect questions like the questions the wise people ask you. When they ask you a wise question, remember that question. Write it down so that you can ask it of other people. Collect questions, because questions are like intricate brass keys that open the lock boxes of people's minds. It's like, if you want to know what's in her mind, ask the right question, and what is in her mind comes out. But if you don't know how to ask the right question, there's no key to open up what's in there. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. So what I'd like to do now is show you the questions that I would encourage you to ask to make any major decision you've got. Now, before I get started on that, though, which is, by the way, on page 12 in the booklet, number 4, I'd like you to pause for a minute. I'd like to give you 15 seconds to sort through your mind, just sort through your mind, and ask, what are the decisions I'm making? But ask yourself, if I could only make one decision that would free up a lot of stuff for me, if I could make that decision right, that's the most important decision I've got to make probably this year. Is this decision? Should I take that job? Should I move to London? Should I go back to school? Should I change my major? Whatever the question is, I'm going to give you 15 seconds to get that in mind, because I'd like to not just teach you how to make decisions, I'd like to give you the tools and let you apply them and see if they help. Okay? So 15 seconds. What is the most important decision you're trying to make at the moment, starting now? Okay, everybody got a decision in mind you're trying to make? Okay. Coming back to this front page where I've got this funny thing drawn here, let me explain what I'm doing. Right now, you're here, sort of going along in life. And what you're coming to is, in a sense, a fork in the road. And you're looking at do I go to London, or do I stay where I am, or do I move to New York City, or some series of decisions you're trying to make. A decision is trying to make a decision between options. In other words, you're trying to figure out what are my options and what's the best one to take. Okay? Now, here's the first question I would ask in light of the question the decision you're trying to make right now. At its essence, in one sentence, what decision am I facing? I would encourage you, whenever you're facing a major decision, write it out in a sentence. Just write it out right now. Just write out, the decision I'm trying to make is, should I, boom. What is it? Write it out. Often just the writing of it helps clarify it in your thinking. As long as it's in your head, it stays a little bit foggy around the edges. When you write it out, it often helps just sort of crystallize your decision. And then what is the bottom line? Meaning, who is involved here? Who does this involve? Who, meaning who, including what does God think of this decision? If you were to ask God, what do you think of this decision? What do you think he would say to you? What if you ask the wisest person you know? Who is that you thought about a little bit ago? If you ask them, what would they think about it? What would they advise you, do you think? Who are the impacted people? If you go here, what does that mean to your children or to your family or to the who? Who's involved in the decision? Secondly, what? What are the implications? You look and you say, what are the implications here? You say, what are the dollar amounts? Well, this one pays this much, this one pays this much, this one pays this much. That's one of the implications. But what are the implications that you're looking at in terms of pay or position or education or whatever? What are the implications what are the most important things you're trying to get done by making that decision? When? When do you have to make the decision? Let me give you a little just unasked for advice. In a major decision like you've just written down, postpone the decision as long as you can. Most people say, make it as quickly as you can. I say, no, postpone it as long as you can. Because if you can wait another week to make the decision, you may have different information than you've got now. Something else may clarify. Now, if you have to make it tomorrow, make it tomorrow. Because I say, wait as long as you can. In some cases, you can't wait any longer. You have to make it tomorrow because the company needs to know, are you going to take the job or not? Well, if you can wait till tomorrow, wait till tomorrow. But if you can, wait a week. You can't wait a month. Wait as long as you can. Because the longer you wait, the more facts you have to make a wise decision. Why? Why are you making this decision at all? What's your motivation for it? Why are you making it? What's motivating you? What's driving you? What's the main advantage of it to you? What are you looking for? What are you hoping to get out of it? Kind of thing. Why are you making it? How? How will you decide? How will you get there? How will you explain it to people? How will you tell people? How will you... What are the hows involved?
You mean how I'm going to make the decision or how do I...
Anything to do with how. How I make the decision, how I tell my parents, how I tell my wife, mm-hmm. how I process it with my board, how I explain it to my staff. What are the hows that I need to consider? And then how much? How much will it cost if I move to London versus stay where I am versus move to Detroit, Michigan? How much would that cost? How much more will I make? How much? There's ask these kind of questions, and not every one of them will give you an automatic aha, then we'll do C. But any one of them might give you a differentiator that says, you know, based on that, I really think I probably need to do C. You don't know which question is going to be the key because the decision you're making next week, it may be a different thing that turns out to be the secret to making a wise decision. But by asking all these questions, you can make a wiser decision asking these questions in 1 hour in a coffee shop than you can just sort of letting it mull probably for a month. Because just by having a process to go through to think of all the various dimensions of it gives you a systematic track to go on. And like I said, a part of what you're trying to do is make a decision quickly, but making it wisely in a mature way. Number two, have I given myself 24 hours to let this decision settle in my mind? Anything that you possibly can, sleep on it. I've seen so many people come to one conclusion in the afternoon when they're sort of tired, or in the evening when they're sort of tired. They wake up the next morning and it's a whole different decision. They come to a totally different conclusion, just with rest. And so give yourself at least 24 hours, if you possibly can, to think through a decision. Now, again, certain decisions you can't give yourself time for. You have to do it as soon as you can. Now, here's another little insight. The importance of the decision you're trying to make depends in large part how long it would take to reverse it if you make the wrong decision. Example. Let's say, for example, you ask me, do you want these chairs, these five chairs here, when you leave the room, do you want them put in a circle or a square? I can make that decision immediately, like put it in a circle. Because 2 minutes later, if I decide it's better to do a square, I say, oh, never mind, put it in a square. But if you said, do you want to buy this hotel or not? I can't say yes. Because it would take me a long time if I committed to it, maybe to resell it. I may own it for 10 years or something without being able to resell it. You take a lot longer time. If it's going to take you a longer time to change your mind if you decide to go a different way, the quicker you can change what you've decided, the quicker your decision can be. But give yourself 24 hours on major decisions like you're thinking about. Am I thinking about this decision with a clear head, or am I fatigued to the point where I shouldn't be making major decisions? A lot of times, frankly, your decision-making process, if you're feeling exhausted, is simply to get it out of the way. It's like, I'm going to decide, well, let's just move to Detroit because I'm so tired. I'm tired of thinking about it. Well, that's the wrong time to make a decision like you're trying to make right now, I guarantee you. Number three, what would happen if we did not do what we're planning to do? The decision you're trying to make, what would happen if you didn't do it at all? Would it really hurt you? Would it hurt someone else? Mm-hmm. What if you didn't decide that? What if you did not decide to go to London? What difference would that make? What if you decided not to stay where you are? What difference would that make? What difference would it make if you decided not to go to Detroit, Michigan? Another is, what difference will this decision make in 10 years, 5 years, 10 years, 100 years from now? In other words, looking out 5, 10, 15, 20 years, if we decide to move to London, 20 years from now, what difference will that have made? If we decide to stay here, what difference will it made? And if we decide to move to, let's call it Orlando, Florida, what difference would that have made? Sometimes the finest question you can ask as a board member is, what would be the ideal decision long term? The I was working on a Focus on the Family decision. We were trying to decide whether to build one of the next buildings. It was about $22 million at the time. And the board discussed it for probably 2.5 hours. We were just debating, should we or shouldn't we, and where are we going to get the money, and have we got enough money? And all, I mean, it just went on for 2.5 hours, and we just got tired of discussing it, frankly. I mean, I was ready to just sort of cash it in and say, well, let's just wait till next year to decide it or something. And one of the board members said, well, what would be the ideal solution long term? 2 minutes later, we had voted unanimously, yes, we'll build it. Because everyone knew long term, it was the wise thing to do. Mm-hmm. But we were looking all at the short term. I'm saying sometimes the decision you're trying to make that you've written on your paper there, to get the right perspective on it, you need to look at it in the long term, not just the short term. Well, short term, it may be a big hassle to move to London, but long term, it might be the best thing to do. What are the key assumptions we're making? What are we assuming it'll really cost? What are we assuming it will be its real benefits? When you're in your coffee shop trying to make the decision you're trying to make, you might make a list of all the assumptions you're making. If we move to London, this will be true and this will be true, and we'll attend this church and we'll do this and this and this and this, and it'll cost about this much. And here's what the benefits will be. Here's what the costs will be. Here's what the benefits will be. And then take it to the wisest person you know and say, I'm thinking about this. Would you check my assumptions and see if I'm assuming anything that you think is wrong? Am I making any incorrect assumptions here? And a lot of times, they'll look at it as an outside objective observer and say, well, you're assuming a 4-to-1 ratio return. I've never seen more than a 2-to-1. And at 4-to-1, I can afford to do it. At 2-to-1, I can't. In other words, you may be making certain assumptions that are wrong assumptions, that are very obvious to someone from the outside looking in. So make a list of the benefits and the costs. What you're assuming to be true, assumption is simply what you assume to be true, whether it is or not. Make a list of those assumptions. Run them by your staff, your board, your spouse, your dad, your mom, your someone, and see if there's anything that stands out to them as immediately an incorrect assumption, or at least the assumption you better check out, because I'm not sure that one's right. Number six, how will this decision affect our overall master plan? Will this get us off track or speed us along our way? In other words, if we move to London, is that going to help us with our plan, or is it going to get us off track? Or if we move anywhere else, which one of these will be? It's like if our life plan or our master plan is to go here, maybe the London decision would take us here long term. Maybe the staying where we are would sort of get crossways, and maybe moving to Orlando would actually sort of go that way. Mm-hmm. In other words, which of these three decisions, three options you've got, would be the wisest to help you actually accelerate your plan versus move against your plan? Because you don't necessarily want to change your plan just to accommodate one decision. Should we seek outside counsel on this decision? There are certain kind of technical decisions. You may need an outside paid consultant, or you may need someone who is just outside of your organization, or you may need to just call your board in and say, hey, I'm trying to make this decision. Our staff we've been talking about it for a couple of days now. We can't quite come to clarity on it. Could you help us? Now, call for outside counsel. How does your spouse and family feel about the decision? Honey, how'd you feel about moving to London versus staying where we are versus moving to Orlando, Florida? In terms of where we're going long term, what are your thoughts on that? What's your spouse's thought on it? I've seen a lot of people make decisions come home and announce decisions rather than to ask questions and include in the process and then come to a mutual conclusion. I'll guarantee you which way works better. Have we checked references? Like, for example, if the decision you're trying to make is, should we hire person A or B or C to be our new director of whatever? Let me give you a couple of hints on reference checking. Number one, do not ask their current employer. Because if they're not doing well where they are, their current employer will say, oh, they're incredible. Yes, take them, because we want to get rid of them. Ask two employers back or three employers back. Would you rehire them? Why or why not? What did you see as their greatest strength when they were working with you? That kind of thing. That's one suggestion. A second suggestion is, instead of calling employers, consider calling mentors. What you do is you ask the candidates, who have been your two or three life mentors? And they'll say, well, Edmund. Edmund has been one of my chief mentors, this person says. You say, do you have his phone number? Do you mind if I call him and talk to him? And you call Edmund and you say, Edmund, Zingo has applied for a position with us, and he said you're one of his life mentors. He said, Zingo? I don't even know a Zingo. Well, it tells you something right away, right? Oh, yeah, I remember. I met him about 10 years ago. I haven't talked to him for 10 years. That tells you something else. If he says, yes, I've known him for 20 years, I would be honored to be considered his mentor. Then you say something like this. Well, Zingo has applied for a position with our organization. And the last thing we want to do is set him up for failure. We don't want to move him across country 200 miles with his family, get them uprooted from their church and their school and everything, uproot their family, move at expense to them and expense to us, move him here 200 miles only to find out it was a mistake. So if you don't mind, I'd like to ask you a few very candid questions about Zingo to make sure, as we possibly can, that it's a good fit for him as well as for us. Well, when you ask that of a mentor that really cares for Zingo, you're going to get some very clear, candid answers. And you always start the question of the mentor with, what do you see as Zingo's single greatest strength? What does he do the very best? Or what does Zelda do the very, very, very best? Because that starts on a positive note, etc. And a part of what you're trying to figure out is this person you're interviewing, what do they do the best? Because that's where you want to use them. If their best is they can dunk a basketball from the free throw line, well, and what you need is an accountant, you see the mismatch right there. But I'm saying ask mentors. Mentors will give you far more information. I ask mentors, have you ever seen Zingo tell even a white lie? Well, yeah, he'll tell white lies here and there, but nothing serious. The interview is over. Because if he'll tell you a white lie, he'll tell you a black one. Okay? But if a mentor says, you know, I've known him for 20 years, I've never seen him do anything but straightforward. He's as honest as they come. Then you can trust when Zingo's in the interview, he's telling you the truth. But if you're getting black lies and white lies and over and stuff from his mentor, you can't trust anything he's telling you. Because if you can't trust a person at every point, you can't trust him at any point. Because you don't know which point you're at. Have we done our due diligence? Number eight. What are our very best three options? And can the big decision be broken into subparts to lower our risk? In other words, what are your three best options in the decision? Detroit, stay where we are, or London, stay where we are, or Orlando. By subparts, I mean, has our family ever actually visited London? Have we ever driven around in the area we might live in or visited the church that we'd be called to? Has our family done that? By the way, one quick another bit of advice. When you're going to be interviewed by a firm, you're going to apply for a position. What you're halfway assuming is they're going to ask me a lot of questions and they'll make a decision. Wrong assumption. Right assumption. They're going to ask me a lot of questions. Then I'm going to ask them a lot of questions. And then they will decide whether they want me, and I will decide whether I want them. It is not a one-way decision. Is it best for them and best for us and best for the people? Is it a triple win, or do they win but I don't? And unless they will answer my questions, just like if you won't answer their questions, you won't get the job. Unless they answer your questions, you won't take the job. Don't assume it's a one-way communication when you're applying for a position. Number nine, is this what we would do if we had twice the budget? In other words, if you had twice the budget you've got, which of these three would you do? Sometimes that makes a decision, that makes something real clear. What if we had half the budget? What if we had five times as much time? What if we didn't have to make the budget, make the decision until June, till fall? What if we had to make the decision right away? What if we had twice as many staff people? What if we had half as much staff? Number 10, what's the best timing? If not now, when? Why not? Why not now? And then here's a question I'd like to teach you to ask yourself many times over the next 50 years. If someone held a loaded gun to my head and forced me to decide in the next 2 minutes, what would I decide and why? I talked about this morning. I said, if someone held a .357 revolver to your head and said, in 2 minutes you have to make this decision, what would you say? He said, whatever they wanted me to. But if you had to make, just in a fantasy world, if you had to make the decision in 2 minutes, which of these three things you would do? If you had to decide right now in 2 minutes what you would do with the decision you're trying to make, what would you do? Now, the reason I say that is because, you know what? Normally, our instincts are very good. We know which we'll end up doing. We're just trying to convince ourselves that it's right or wrong. And so what you do, the quicker you can ask that up front and say, well, if I decide in 2 minutes, I'd go to London. Then you move to a different question, that is, but what would be the lingering questions I would have before I move to London? Because you've already decided you want to move to London. Now, what do I have to confirm or assumption I need to check before I just make a final decision on it? Okay? What I would suggest to you is that this is the start of, this is 10, probably 50 questions that you carry around in your legal pad or you put in your desk. And any major decision you have to make pretty quickly, I'd run past these questions before I'd say yes, no, or maybe. That makes sense to everybody? Okay. And then what I'd also suggest is that you add your own with the next 50 years of your experience. In other words, when you're making a decision and someone asks a question that really helps sort of open up things and make things clear, make a note of it and add it to it so that you develop a list of questions that you go through every time you're making a major decision. And it will help you make wise decisions. It'll help you make mature decisions. It will help you give you questions that'll get to the facts quickly. It'll help you make as speedy decision as you can so that you're not holding your staff up or holding your spouse up or holding things up any longer than you have to, but still making mature decisions that are wise. Okay? Now, we're going to switch over to problem solving, and then we'll go to question answer, okay? If you turn to page, and we're not going to sing, in our church, in the church I grew up in, they'll say, now, let's all turn to hymn number, page number 55 and sing Leaning on the Everlasting Arms. We're not going to sing this one. But this grid on page number 22, number 10 in your booklet here, shows the process steps down the left checking your personal balance, prioritizing, getting a context that's clear, what's causing it, options, decision, action, and marking your trail. But the profound questions are these. Number one, but before I get into that, what problem are you trying to solve today? Now, let me explain that a problem, the difference between a decision and a problem. You remember I said a decision is making a choice between alternatives. A problem is understanding why we were supposed to be at point A and we ended up at point B. The distance between where you were and where you hope to be is defined as a problem. The distance between where you are and where you hope to be is the problem. Pardon me?
The whole.
Okay.
What is the difference between problems and decision?
Okay. Decision is when you're trying to make a decision as to which of three things or so you should do. Should I move to London, or should I stay where I am, or should I move to Detroit or Orlando? This is, I thought we were going to raise $100,000, and we only raised $10,000. We've got a $90,000 problem. In other words, it's the difference between what we'd hoped we would do and what we actually did. Okay? Okay, in everybody's mind? What problem are you wrestling with at the moment that you would pay someone the most money if they could just snap their fingers and solve for you? You say, if someone could solve this for me, I'd be willing to pay them big dollars for what big dollars are to me. I'd pay them $10. I'd pay them $100. I'd pay them $1,000 if they could solve this problem for me. What problem are you trying to solve in your life? Let me ask you these questions in relationship to that. Everybody have one? Because we're all dealing with problems all the time. That's part of the reality of leadership, is that we all are dealing with problems all of the time. And when you get a problem solved, doesn't mean problems go away. It just means the next one shows up. The next one comes up to the top. But you're always dealing with a problem somewhere in the system. There never gets to the point where you have no problems left. By the way, let me stop here just a second. A pastor in the United States named Rick Warren wrote a book called Purpose-Driven Life. Now, I've met Rick, but we're not good friends. I mean, I don't know him really well. We'll email back and forth a couple of times, but I don't know him really well. I knew, like, Bill Bright and Josh McDowell and Jim Dobson and Jim Kennedy. I knew them well, but I don't know Rick Warren well. But the other day he said something that I'd like to give you the essence of it because it was so helpful to me. He said, I used to see life as a roller coaster. You were either up or down. He said, I had highs and I had lows. He said, I don't see it that way anymore. I see it like a railroad track going through history, where on your finest day, you still have pain in your life. And on your worst day, you still have hope. And I thought, you know what? That's what I've actually experienced. On the best day I can remember, I had pain in my heart for some things. And on the worst day I can remember, I still had hope for things we're going to, you know, things we're working on. And I'm saying, don't look forward to the day when everything will be okay, because it won't get here. I'm saying realistically, it won't get here. But a part of that dynamic balance is what God uses to shape us into sort of who He wants us to be. We're a combination of thankful for what He's done and in a position of needing Him to do more. So the problem you're trying to solve doesn't solve all your problems, but the one you're trying to solve, let's look at it this way. Again, how is my personal balance or imbalance affecting my perceptions of this problem? Something that when you're rested seems like easy to deal with. When you're exhausted, feels like it's impossible. You need to stay in touch with where you are physically and emotionally, meaning you need to be able to develop a gauge in your own system that says, right now I'm exhausted, or right now I feel on top of the world, or right now I feel fine. And if you don't have that, figure out a way to get it. Because you need to develop that to be able to make the right decisions in the right way and solve problems in the right way. Because if you think, nothing wrong with me, I haven't slept for 7 days, and I haven't eaten for 4 days, and I'm exhausted, but everything's okay, you're fooling yourself. But if you know when you're exhausted, and you take that into account, that's wisdom. So, in the problem you're trying to solve, is part of the reason that the answer has eluded you, or not, you haven't been able to solve it quickly, is it partly because of how tired you are? Because you've been going so hard, you've been working so hard that you're just exhausted. You say, no, I feel good. Okay, let's move on then. But I'm saying, your first question in solving problems is, how are you right now in terms of just your personal fatigue level? Mm-hmm. Secondly, what is my single most important problem? What you're going to find in life is that a lot of problems can start floating around in your head. And you say, I've got to solve this, and I've got to solve this, and I've got to solve this, and you're trying to solve them all at once. Don't try to solve problems all at once. Mm-hmm. Make them line up and get in roll, single file. And here's another reality. You don't have to solve the toughest problem first. It's ideal, probably. But you know what? On certain days, I don't have the energy to take on certain problems. I think I could solve this little tiny problem, but that's about as much as I can do today, frankly. I'm saying, give yourself permission not to feel like I have to do the biggest problem first. I say, today you may make tremendous progress if you just solve a couple little ones, okay? But you want to ask yourself, what is my biggest problem? And then, what is the appropriate context for this problem? Remember, nothing is meaningful without a context. So the more context you can put, the easier it is to solve the problem. Now, what I mean by that is, let's say you've got a problem with a staff member that you don't know what to do. They were supposed to maybe they're your funding department, and again, they were supposed to raise $100,000, say, for you this year, and so far they've only raised 10. And that $90,000 is putting you in a crunch. You got a $90,000 problem. Well, what is the context of that problem? Well, among other things, is the context is, where has that person been? Meaning, have they been sick for the last 3 months? Well, if they've been sick in bed for the last 3 months, no wonder they haven't done this. But if they've been healthy and well, and just have been lazy, that's a different context. And if they've been trying hard and talking to people every day but no one responds to them, that's a different context. In other words, to understand this problem, you have to understand, have I got the right person? Have I got the right person but they're just sick? Have I got the wrong person? Have I got a person that'll take me 5 years to get trained? What is the situation here? What's the context of it? Then, what is the central cause or principal violation of the problem? I don't know how to draw the Danube, but I know how to do something that makes Americans laugh when I draw the Mississippi River. This is the Mississippi River, and this is the Delta, okay? It isn't what the Mississippi looks like at all, but this is about a 1,500-mile or so river that goes from, like, Minnesota down to where, Louisiana or somewhere. I don't even really know where it goes. But let's say you've got polluted water. all of a sudden you find that all along the Mississippi, there is a viral pollution of some kind. And it's totally polluted. You can try to solve that pollution by starting at the symptom level, or you can approach it at the cause level. The symptom level starts down here. Well, we can start here and we can put a $500,000 filtration system here and it'll make clean water here. And then we can put another $500,000 here, or $5 million, and put clean water here. Another $5 million here, another $5 million here. We're $20 million down and we've got quite a bit of clean water. Instead, if you look for cause, you start at the first place you have clean water. And you say, we've got clean water here, dirty water. The minute you hit dirty water, you look for the plant that's dumping chemicals into the river. You shut that plant down or make it get a filtration that stops the pollution. The second you shut that one down, you don't even have to put a filtration system. You just wait for a month and all of a sudden you got clear water, clear down to here. And all of a sudden you've got dirty water again. Within a half a mile of where you find your first dirty water, you're going to have a pipe dumping junk into the river. You knock out that pipe and you wait a month and then you've got clean water clear down to here. You've got dirty water again. You see the logical difference here? What is causing your problem? What's causing it? Deal with causes, not symptoms. What are our top three options? Then you go to decision making. You go, all right, if this is our problem, what are our three best options? We could hire someone new, we could wait till they get well, or we could bring in someone to supplement it or something like that. In other words, once you find out what the problem really is, you have to move to what are we going to do about it? What decision are we going to make? And then how can we become more effective and efficient in the future? Peter Drucker says, he makes this distinction, which I've always found helpful. He said, efficiency is doing things right. Efficiency is doing things right. But effectiveness is doing right things. Efficiency is doing things right. But effectiveness is doing right things. As part of what your problem is you're very efficient in doing what you're doing, but you're doing the wrong thing. You're very efficient in what you're doing, but are you possibly doing the wrong thing? So you want to ask, what could I be doing that would be more effective in doing what I want to helping get done what I want to do? And then how can we move toward the ideal? Again, that's one of the best questions you'll ever hear is, how can we move the problem you're trying to solve? How could we do it in a more ideal way? As a matter of fact, you could ask that for a full year of the problem you're working on, probably, and just keep improving it each time you answer the question.
Can you repeat the question?
How can we move toward the ideal? It's the next to the last question on page 22. Okay? And then, lastly, what I call mark your trail. What did we learn in dealing with this problem? In other words, what did you learn by dealing with this problem that can help you deal with the next time, either prevent it from happening or solve it faster? Every time you get a decision made or a problem solved major, you want to ask, what did I learn for the next 500 decisions I have to make or the next 500 problems I encounter? What are the principles I learned? What are the questions that unlocked it quicker? Etc. We've now covered decisions and we've covered problems. But I want to leave you this week with at least 7 and tomorrow 8 major tools that will help you be able to quickly clarify the issues you face in leadership as you go home. So what questions do you have about any of this that's unclear, or that I may be able to help with. Questions? The question is, for the tape, is there any hierarchy in the questions we ask on decision-making or problem-solving, really? And I say, I would encourage you to look carefully and see if you can find one. I've ordered them in an order that I would tend to ask them. But my priority or my sequence of asking them may be different than would be helpful to you. If it is, simply redo them. Retype it on another sheet of paper and carry that with you so that however you find what and add questions to it, you find some question I ask never helps, erase it. So that what you're trying to do is develop over a lifetime because we're looking, frankly, at a daily occurrence. Because every day you're going to be asked to make decisions, and every day you're going to be able to, you're going to be asked to solve problems, or assign problems to someone to solve who may not be able to solve them. They come back to you with them. So the better you can get, the more efficient, effective you can be at making decisions and solving problems. It'll make your day go much better. So what if, for example, you took an hour a month for a whole year and all you did was refine that list of questions. But you've got now 30 years so that any major problem that comes up, you ask them in your sequence with all the wise questions you could add to it, all the questions your advisor could ask to it, erase half of mine, whatever, but come to a list of questions. The real beauty is that if you ask those consistent problems quickly, in 1 hour, you can consider a lot of perspectives. So, rearrange them any way you like. But that's the sort of the sequence I would tend to use. The question is there ever an exception to this way of processing decisions and problems? Because of what Samuel did as he was appointing the next king. And the answer is, yes, there would be times in which God may tell you or intervene or lay something on your heart or bring something to your mind that you would ask something totally different or come up with a fourth option no one's thinking about or come to say, you know, I don't think any one of these three are right. I don't know what four is, but I don't like any of these three. You can do...
Extra option.
There, what other options have we got? Because I don't think any of these are good options. You can do that. Let me tell you a discussion I had with Bill Bright one time. I said, Bill, how do you actually go about your day? How do you queue up your day? And he said, well, I get up in the morning, I pray, and I say, Lord, here is the schedule they've laid out for me today. This is what I'm planning to do, unless you make it clear that I'm supposed to do something else. But he said, every day I say, Lord, you have unlimited permission to adjust this agenda any way you like. Insert anyone into the agenda that I'm not expecting. Take anyone out. Make them forget the appointment or whatever. Take anyone out of this agenda. Put anyone in the agenda. But unless I hear differently from you, this is the way I'm going to... This is my day. I thought that was really wise. And I say, I think the decision-making and the problem-solving is the same way. That you could pray about it and say, Lord, if there's any other questions I should be asking, if there's any other candidates, any other options, bring them to mind. Absolutely. And again, I'm not saying this is the only list. I'm saying it's just a list. And I hope you can see the value of having a list. And if you could this year refine this list to the point where you've got a list that you can share with your staff for 2012 or 2015 or whatever, it just strengthens their ability to make decisions and solve problems as well. And add whatever questions you want in terms of is there an option we're not thinking? Is God telling us anything that we're not considering? Question is, how do I know if the decision I think God wants me to go in and I want to go in is just the direction I want to go in, or if it's the one God wants me to go in. Let me give you a part of my theology. We may be running out of paper. I think I can still get it on here. I think at the end of your life, now, I'm going to draw a little line here, that if you came up here and looked at it closely, you'd see sort of goes scribbly up and down, different ways, etc. But if I look at it far enough back, if I went back 100 yards and looked at it, that could look like a straight line, right? I think that what we experience is this jagged line right here. And we go a certain way and God takes us another way. And we think this is the way to go and He takes us a different way. And to us it seems like we're going this way and then that way and then this way and that way. I think when we get to heaven we'll see that it was all a straight line from His perspective. That the mistakes we made were part of our learning process. That the wrong people we chose to be on our staff, the people we let go we shouldn't have let go, etc. It's like, but all of it is working to good for those who love the Lord. Mm-hmm. So I don't worry about making bad decisions. Mm-hmm. I say I may worry about living the consequences of some of the bad decisions I make, but I don't wonder, is this what God wants of me today? Because I make an assumption, if that's what I do, that's what He had in mind to teach me something or to accelerate my progress in that direction. So I just relax with that and say, you're not going to make 100% decisions right, no matter how hard you try. You're going to look back a year or two or five from now and say, I wish I hadn't done that. I'm not sure that was the right way. But as you pray about it and you seek counsel on it and you ask good questions about it, you'll find you make less and less decisions you regret.
What if a person is, someone has all the facts and he has options, mm-hmm. and he's a very positive person, so in long term, every option can look very good.
Mm-hmm. What if you come up with a situation where you've got three options and they all look great. You can see the potential in all of them. Then let me show you a way that I actually work with all the time. I do this probably average year-round once or twice a day for the last 10 years. Whenever you've got three options, they are typically not three equal options. They all look good. Any one of them would work. But what you do is you give them, if I have these three options, let me show you how it works. Write three people who report to you or are colleagues of yours. Just write any three people. Three people you're dating. Three people that... three people you wish you've dated. Just write down any three people you want. On your piece of paper, just their first name. Just write down three names. Could be a staff, could be a friend, could be a whatever. Just write down three names. Now, on a scale of 1 to 10, if it's a staff member, if you could only keep one, which one would you keep? That would be number one. If you could only keep two, which one would you keep? This would be number two. This would be number three, maybe. But the way I usually do it is to rate them 1 to 10, where I say, what I do every day nearly, is I look at some list and I say, on a scale of 1 to 10, if this is the perfect date, or if this is the perfect candidate, or if this is the perfect solution, is a 10, how would I rate these three options? Well, this is certainly a 10. this is probably a 9, this is probably an 8. That means any one of them would do. But for some reason, I think this is slightly a better decision than those other two. And so it's like, you're just, it's a way to, it's an artificial way of weighting, putting weight on one, a little bit more weight on one than the other. I asked Barney Visser, who owns a major furniture chain in the United States, one day, I said, Barney, how do you, by the way, if you listen to NASCAR at all, he has a NASCAR that at Daytona came in 7th, but at Talladega, I think it was, came in 1st last week. For the first time, his NASCAR has won 1st, so he was very happy. But I said, Barney, how do you decide who to pay over $500,000 a year to in salary and bonus? He said, that's an interesting question. He owns 2 jets, so he's never in a hurry. He doesn't have to hurry to get to the airport. The jet leaves when he gets there, not like me, where if I'm not there, the jet leaves anyway. The airplane leaves anyway. He said, let me think about that. And he thought about it for about 5 minutes. He said, okay, I think I've got an answer. He said, anyone that can build a great team is very valuable to me. He said, secondly, I want a person to put the right weight on the right variables. I said, Barney, I think I know what you mean by that, but give me one example. And he said, I don't want a person to put $1,000 worth of time on a nickel problem or a nickel's worth of time on a $1,000 problem. I said, I got it. You don't ever have to explain that again.
Can you say it again, please?
He said, I don't want a person to put a nickel's worth of time on a $1,000 problem or a $1,000 worth of time on a nickel problem. And it's putting what I call wisdom in putting the right weight on the right variables. And one of the ways that I weight things is 1 to 10. Anytime you've got a list, they aren't all 10s typically. They're often 1 or 2 10s, a couple of 9s, a couple of 8s, maybe even a couple of 3s or 4s. But when you get to it, let's say you have 2 10s, then you'd say, all right, if you could only have one, held a gun to your head, in the next 2 minutes you have to decide, which one do you keep? Which one would you take? Your mind will give it to you. You say, well, if I had to, I'd choose this one. If I had to choose, I'd choose this one. That gives you the number one. The question is, what is the chart about priorities? What you want to do as a leader is to keep track of what Stephen Covey would call the boulders. Because you've got so many pieces of what I would call dust. In other words, in your life, you've probably got X number of emails to answer a day, X number of questions to answer for your staff. You've got maybe 100 things you have to react to in a given day. But how do you keep track of the most important, how do you keep track of the boulders? The big issues, not just the dust. And so what I do, I put questions, which means I have to answer it. I put problems, which means I have to fix it. I put goals, which means I have to add it. And I put opportunities, which means I have to grab it. And I say, all right, in the next 90 days, what are the top 3 questions I have to answer for my staff, in my life? What are the top 3 questions I have to wrestle with and come to an answer on? What are the top 3 problems there are things in our existing organization or in my life that are broken that I have to fix, like the air conditioning doesn't work at the house or the office or something? What are the top 3 things I have to fix? And then what are the top 3 things I have to keep working on adding staff, adding budget, adding building space, adding furniture, adding new things that I have to add? And then what are the top 3 major things that might be opportunities that I could grab while they're available, because if I don't grab them now, they're gone forever. So that's what that is. You're welcome. By the way, at least in America, what I found is that most people that you'll ever meet, most adults do not have a plan at all. They live day to day. Those that do don't have a 5-year plan or a 3-year plan or a 2-year plan. A few of them have a 1-year plan, like what I'd like to get done this year. But those who have plans at all tend to think in terms of seasonal plans. Duck hunting season, deer hunting season, football season, basketball season, baseball season. And they usually look ahead about 3 months. Football's coming, or soccer's coming, or rugby's coming, or something. It's about a 3-month planning cycle. And what I find is that people on your staff can imagine the next 90 days typically easier than they can imagine anything else. They can imagine that a lot easier. They're used to thinking in terms of the next 90 days or so what's going to happen, not in the next year what's going to happen. That's why I put the 90 days here, because it's easy for people to keep track of it. You can use, by the way, this exact same chart, put another one on the same sheet that's for 1 year. In other words, if you want to keep a bigger picture, say, in the next year, what are the questions I need to answer, problems to fix, goals to reach, opportunities to grab? If you want to have an even bigger picture, you say in the next 10 years. Now, I don't recommend it, but I'm saying you could. You could say, in the next 10 years, we're going to have to answer, do we send our kids to college or not? Or are we going to have a college fund to send them? Or these are questions we're going to have to answer in the next 10 years or whatever. You could do it that way. But 90 days is the most typical, typically the most helpful time frame. The question is, how did I come to write the book, Why You Do What You Do? Because it's more of a clinical psychologist book. As a matter of fact, a lot of psychologists use that book. A lot of counseling centers use that book. They have their intake patients read the book, fill it out, and the first time they meet with a counselor, they tell them, here are my answers. And then the counselor starts counseling them based on it. So you're right. But how does that fit? Well, I basically don't just write on leadership. I write on and think about leadership and management and life. And what I do is, my mind, for whatever reason, God has given me a mind that sees patterns quickly. And I've interviewed people one-to-one for 50,000 hours. And when you listen to executives one-to-one telling where they need help, what they've done, what caused it, that you listen to these people talk for hours and hours, pretty soon patterns begin to come up. And I began to see the pattern in why people did what they did. And it turns out there are only 8 reasons people do what they do. Matter of fact, I'll give them to you quickly. And if you want to know how it fits, you can get the book, Why You Do What You Do. You've got a copy. Just hold it up so people can see what it is. Okay? The 8 reasons people do what they do, and all people need these 8 things. Everyone in the room needs all 8 of these, but we don't need them all the same. Some need them at a 10 level. That's very important to me. Others need it at 1 or 2 level. I've had that all my life. That's not that big a deal. But the 8 needs that you want to ask yourself is, what is my greatest need? And you want to make sure that you know what your spouse's greatest need is number 1 is to be loved, to be significant, to make a significant difference, to be admired, looked up to be recognized, to be appreciated, to be secure, to be respected, and to be accepted. Pardon me? Which page is it? Page 15 of the Asking Profound Questions book. Those are listed at the bottom. Why you do it, you do. Right here, page 15. Okay? And what I began to see was that there were very clear patterns of what people needed. And what I began to see was that your childhood, what you experience in childhood, if you tell me which of these you need the most, I can predict what your childhood was like. I can also predict what your adult phobic fears are. I can also predict your surest, safest way to relate to people. I can also predict your greatest strength. I can also predict your backup style, which is not pretty, but if your needs are not met in a positive way, I can predict what you'll go to, what lengths you'll go to have your needs met. All of that is extraordinarily predictable. I wrote the book about 15 years ago. I haven't seen an exception to it since. In other words, it is extremely predictable. That's why I wrote the book, so that people could understand why they do what they do. And why. And again, sometimes I've dealt with couples who are married 30 years, and I'd go through this, and I'd say, what is your need, and what do you think is your wife's need? And ask her, what is your need, and what do you think is your husband's need? 1 to 10, how would you rate? She said, I need 10 at this level. By the way, this is not gender-based. I've seen women need all of these at a 10 level, and I've seen them need it at a 1 level. I've seen men need it at a 10 level and a 1 level. It's not gender-based at all. But I ask, okay, what do you need? She says, well, I need this. He looks at her and he says, you need what? We've been married for 30 years. You need what? You never told me you needed that. Well, Harry, that's what I've been telling you for 30 years. You just don't listen. And then he tells her what he needs, and she said, well, I didn't know you needed that. I'll tell you why. We tend to try to meet in other people the need we have in ourselves. We assume if I need it, they need it. But that may not be what they need at all. And what we may not need at all, they may need the most. And that's why couples sometimes find it very frustrating that my needs aren't being met, etc. Well, that's how I got into that book. And by the way, if I had to talk on one topic every night for a year, it'd drive me crazy. But if I've concluded, if I had to talk on one topic every night for a year, what I would do is talk on that book right there. It wouldn't be on leadership or management, it'd be on that one. The reason is because when I talk on it, there is so much emotional breakthrough that people say, no wonder my dad did this. No wonder my mother did this. By the way, a quick thing. If you want to understand yourself really well, do not study your parents. Study your grandparents. Because your grandparents are the ones that affected your parents, and your parents are byproducts of your grandparents. You often think, well, my daddy did this to me. And it feels like my dad didn't do this. I say, well, how did his dad treat him? Well, worse than me. I say, we could go on and on for hours on this topic. I'll just say with that, I hope you can come back tomorrow, because we've got one more concept to go through in this that I think you'll find really, really helpful. One more concept right here on keeping the big picture of your organization. If you're leading an organization, if you're on a board, if you want to keep the big picture of your organization, tomorrow will be very helpful. It's a very helpful tool. It's proven a lot of organizations. So I see you tomorrow. If I don't see you again in this life, Godspeed. Thanks.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thank you.